Welcome to Asian Pacific Voices Radio, where you'll find stimulating conversations that explore diverse topics and stories impacting our Asian Pacific American communities. I'm your host, Rasha Goel, and today I am excited to introduce my very special guest. She's a multi-talented 13-language vocalist, concert pianist, and classically trained violinist who has captivated audiences on a global scale. Her illustrious career has seen her heading crossover performances in major televised events, such as sports arenas, festivals, including America's Got Talent, Special Olympics World Games, and Burning Man. Known for her virtuoso coloratura and dynamic performances, her diverse talent spans classical arias, crossover pieces in jazz, pop, and alternative rock, and even a groundbreaking remix of Skrillex's Kyoto. Hailing from Tokyo and Taipei, her journey from performing in the Taiwan National Recital Hall at 15 to become president and CEO of Asian Hall of Fame and CEO of the Robert Chin Foundation showcases her global cultural perspective. It's my pleasure and honor to welcome Maki May on Asian Pacific Voices Radio. Maki, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Rasha. That was an amazing introduction. I'm going to use that on my LinkedIn.
Awesome. Happy that we could help you with that. You know, you have our pleasure. You have such a fascinating background. I want to start off with talking about your childhood. Now, you are Chinese, Japanese, Korean American who lived in Tokyo and Taiwan before moving to the US. And I also learned from an article that as a baby, you were born with serious complications that could have been also life-threatening. So tell us a little bit about your childhood.
Well, Rasha, thank you for saying I'm fascinating. And I'm fascinating because my parents are fascinating and their parents are fascinating. I think that we all stand on the shoulders of people before us. And I definitely have to see that's the case in the family. My mother is the 52nd generation of a very long family and a long heritage that traces its roots back to Korea. The Silla Kingdom fell and all the women and children were granted passage to Japan. And this was 52 generations. So she's 52 wow. generations ago. I'm 53rd. My children are 54th and their children will be 55th. While they were in Japan, they then became scholars and historians of the court. And today our family emblem is the Prime Minister of Japan's official seal. And it's also on the back of the 500 yen coin. We maintained being Japanese and being Korean at the same time. They don't have dual citizenships in Japan, but they maintain their Korean passport and the Korean name Kim. My mother then immigrated to the United States because despite her long legacy and heritage in Asia, she wanted to be an attorney, not possible. She wanted to be a professor, not celebrated. She did not want to follow the traditional path of getting married at the age of 20 and having five kids by 25. She wanted to be an educator. And America was the only place where she felt that could happen. Now, my father, on the other hand, he comes from a long legacy of businessmen. His mother was the daughter of the mayor of Taoyuan, but because she eloped with my grandfather, she was disowned. And by the time my dad was 15, he was pretty much orphaned. His sister was sold to another family. His three brothers were Taiwanese, but Taiwan was a colony of Japan, so they fought in Papua New Guinea, and they all died. His parents passed away, so my father was left pretty much to fend for himself. He walked 3 days to the port. One American ship said they couldn't take him because he couldn't speak English, but the other one said they were going to Japan. And because in Taiwan, it was a colony of Japan, he could speak Japanese. So he hopped on the ship and he went to Japan. And he started his whole finance career in Japan. Eventually, he started the first Chinese-owned bank in Tokyo. He invested in a lot of the heavy industries that we know today. Like he has so many stories of investing in timber in Burma, and he shipped pulp into Japan, and then he invested in the shrimp factories in Thailand and imported shrimp in Japan, and he did all this stuff, and he loved pancakes, so he opened Japan's first pancake store. He did all sorts of things, and then a GI gave him a Hershey's chocolate bar, so he loved chocolate, and he invested in chocolate, became the sole distributor of chocolate in Japan, so he did a lot of work in that regard. And my mom, being a scholar, When she met my father on a blind date, he took her back to Taiwan and she became a professor for 39 years at the university. She had two masters and a PhD in cognitive linguistics and East Asian law. So Rasha, here you see why I'm very strong in languages. And she used cultural ambassadorship and cultural literacy, languages, history, art, as a way to connect and build bridges between Taiwan and Japan. She was the official translator for the Taiwan government. And they sent her to an excursion in Egypt when they had an Egyptian conference. She went to South Africa and she can fully translate English, Japanese, and Mandarin. And then she always said her greatest regret was not learning fluent Korean, because then she would be not just a triple threat, she would have four. And she was very unhappy about her lack of success there. But the languages for me came through music. I was born a blue baby. And that means that your umbilical cord is wrapped around your neck. So when you were born, you're already DOA. So I was blue. I was not breathing. And then 6 months later, I died again of crib death. And my mother resuscitated me from crib death. So these two, not near death, it was actually dead. I was dead. Experiences caused a lot of trauma when they forced me out with metal forceps at that time. It crushed my ear canal. So I cannot hear out of my right ear. And my left ear has about 30% hearing. My parents, nobody knew this. I mean, I didn't know this as a kid. I just knew that I couldn't hear languages very well. I could hear birds. I could feel trains, but I couldn't really input language data. So I spoke my own language, like gibberish, for a few years. And everyone told my mother I needed a special education. I was probably autistic or I had Down syndrome. I needed to be put away in some countryside place in Taiwan. But she felt that there must be a way for me to communicate with the world. And she tried music. As you know, Asians are very passionate about education because for thousands of years, education was the only way to lift your family out of poverty and out of the village and save your village. So education was the way to test in the bureaucratic exams and to get into the bureaucratic circle of the Imperial Palace. So education and exams are really, really important. And my mother believed, you know, that if I was educated in music, just like all of the Asian households, you know, music was a form of not just a skill, but it was a sign of education. 9 out of 10 Asian households have a piano, and that's because the Bolsheviks came from Russia and introduced piano as a way to having elevated stature and violin as elevated stature. And of course, all the girls have to do 2 years of ballet because that showed elevated stature. So we have these age-old traditions that continue to, when I was a kid, my mother said, okay, if she cannot speak, maybe she can communicate through music. So I started when I was 4, which is a common age to start, but I was horrible. I made teachers cry. I hit them with my book. I kicked them with my shoes. I was very angry. I was like Helen Keller. I did not understand what they were saying. I could not hear the music. And one day when I was 7, I suddenly associated that the vibration I felt from the piano connected to some note on the page, which produced something that made everybody clap. And I thought, oh, this is music. It's some kind of like vibrational thing. And it makes some kind of melody thing. And that's what made me connect with the hearing world. And from then on, I was able to work with teachers and I was able to learn how to lip read. I was able to learn how to read body language and vibration in a room. And I was able to navigate the hearing world that way. So music to me is a very special place. It's not really a public arena. To me, I never thought about using music as a way to get on television, like America's Got Talent, and become famous and perform with Skrillex and Diplo. Like, I just thought it was like my own private diary. And I'm just very happy that I'm involved in doing this stuff and included. I was happy to have friends. And that went on for some time in terms of music and what I was doing with music.
It's just, I'm sorry, as I'm listening to you, I just have all these questions in my head that are popping up even more.
Like, we have 20 minutes. I'm like, oh my God.
This is like a whole 2-hour sit down.
It's a whole thing.
But, you know, I have to say, I commend your parents. I love that you mentioned them and how that it's generationally carried on, because I'm thinking of the strength that both of them possessed and their tenacity to create and wanting to do what they felt they wanted to do, especially in the time that they were growing up, and how maybe that strength has led you. And then just, I can only imagine as a child, the challenges that you were going through, because that's not something I can definitely relate to. And still you have persevered and created this whole magic in this industry, which we know can be very challenging. So I'm going to jump really quick to your journey of learning and becoming proficient in multiple instruments. And not even only that, but 13 languages as well. I mean, here you are having to learn, like you said, basically depending on one ear. Mm-hmm. And going through vibrations and counting on that. So talk to me about that. Like, not even one instrument, multiple instruments, and 13 languages.
Yeah, multiple instruments, 13 languages. They call it multi-instrumentalist, and also polyglot, someone who is very attuned to the frequency of the language, because language is all pitch and melody and frequency. So you have to have a certain ear for those things. But what happened with me was, even though I was playing piano, you know, I really felt that I was sensitive to vibrations. For example, I can hear the light bulb, which is why I cannot go to Walmart, because I can hear the light bulb in Walmart's lighting system.
Really?
It's the only big store I cannot go into. I can hear the light bulb. I'm like a dog. So I can hear the light. I know. And once I had to actually turn off the refrigerator because it hums. Well, used to. Nowadays it's more higher efficiency. It hums and it has this like frequency that emits. I could not practice the violin with the fridge on. So my mom had to turn off the fridge. We had to turn off all the lights. Just when I was a kid, I was like practicing my candlelight because like I could hear all this stuff. What I could hear when I was in second grade was I could hear the violin, because it's a very high pitch. It's a very high frequency. It doesn't like sit down here like the cello does.
And I play the viola, so right? I totally get it. I was in the orchestra.
Yeah, it's like a mid-range. So I went home and I said, I want to learn the violin. And at that time, my father had just lost a ton of investments. Like, we had to move out from a mansion on the top of the hill to the projects in Taipei. Like veterans housing, free housing, because he lost all of his, he owed tens of thousands of dollars every month to his lenders, who happened to be the Yakuza of organized crime. So it's just like a really tough time for the family, but you're a kid, you don't know. You're just going home and saying, Mom, I want to play the violin. And she goes, you know, the violin is very expensive. I said, well, I was wondering, I can hear it. And she goes, oh no. I said, well, we have a piano. I said, no, I want to play the violin and I want to join the choir. She said, you know, I don't think it can do both. My mother worked so hard. She had three full-time jobs, one to pay my father's debts. She was a teacher in one university for that. Second was to pay our basic needs. She went to another university full-time for that. And then she taught at a night school so that my sister and I could continue getting educated at the American school in Taipei. And we could continue our lessons, because as an American, you had to belong to the American club. You had to go to the American Community Center. You had to learn tennis, all this stuff. And she said, violin is one more thing. And I said, well, you can take away dance. I don't need to learn dance. I'm not very good at dancing. Katie can do dance and I can do music. So she said, okay. And I started violin. And I'd have to tell you, Rasha, that to today, and I just got off the call with the team about this, it is so important to make sure that our schools, public and private, provide equitable access to the arts, equitable access to great education, math, science, English, history. It's so important that we don't turn our kids just into like a pipeline theme because they should get a big scholarship in this one thing. So forget the arts or forget this. And so important, because without that equitable access to the arts, I would not be here today. My school had orchestra, they had band, and they had choir and theater, and I had a lot of opportunities in the schools that, you know, my parents couldn't afford it. with all the debts my dad had. So I was very lucky that I had all of that exposure, as well as musical theater and drama and all that. And by the time I was in fifth grade, you know, 5 years later, when my dad got out of all of that and moved us back to the mansion on the hill, I was ready to rock. And my languages came very easily because as an American citizen, I grew up in Taiwan. I grew up in Japan also. My father's company was in Tokyo. My mother's professorship was in Taipei. So we commuted a lot back and forth. I had a lot of friends who were international. So this whole idea of, oh, Asians need an identity, I had none of those issues. We were the majority. A lot of Caucasians came to Asia in order to do business with us. So they were very kind to us and put us on a pedestal. We had a lot of Europeans, so I had a lot of European friends, and I quickly was able to learn basic languages and different things, and that just lent itself to studying opera. When I went to Johns Hopkins, I also added my Peabody Conservatory lessons, and I, you know, you have to learn how to sing in French, Italian, German, and Latin are the basic. Then Dvorak composed in Czechoslovakian, so Czech was one. You know, then you have all of the Asian languages. Whenever I was asked to perform, I would learn also bits and pieces of that language. So Tagalog was a big one. So the Filipino embassy always asked me to sing Dahil Sayo. So I have to learn Dahil Sayo. Then Korean, Japanese, Mandarin, right? So it all kind of goes along those veins. Most recently, I sang, I was asked to sing for Israel Relief. So I had to quickly learn the national anthem of Israel, you know, and that was fun because Ravel composed an entire sonnet in Hebrew. So I already had the basics from Ravel, and I was just able to translate that to the Israeli national anthem. So a lot of it is having the opportunity, wow, equitable access to opportunity, and then really going out, Rasha, and saying yes. Don't say no to anything. Yeah. The kids nowadays say no to everything because they see, oh, I say yes, I get into trouble. It's a waste of time. AI is going to take over my job anyway. Why should I even try? Just forget all that for a second. Say absolutely. When I was recruited by the Walt Disney Company 16 years ago to work for Bob Iger and the company in public affairs, the second day, a nice lady pulled me aside. She's passed away now, but she was my mentor. And she said, Maki, if you want to succeed in Hollywood, just say absolutely.
That's what I was taught.
Just say, I can do it. And then go back and figure out how to do it later. But just say, no problem. And like, oh, does this really fit into my calendar? But I think that's so important is just if you're like, hey, you want to go perform in this? Yeah, sure, I can do it. If I can do it, I'm going to be there. That's why when you ask me, Maki, can you be on this podcast? Absolutely, Rasha, happy to do it. And I think that's so important, you know, in learning about music and instruments and also your capacity. Coming to the United States, I was 15 years old, even though I was an American citizen, I didn't know a lot about the culture. So when I started to play with EDM and Skrillex and Burning Man and all that, I was also asked to do a lot of things on the rock side, and I didn't know a lot of things. I was floored when I went to NAMM. Now, NAMM is an annual kind of merchants convention in Anaheim every year. It draws about 130,000 musicians and gear companies and technical engineers, and we all gather. It's like the Wall Street of music every year. Mm. And I said, where's the violin section? And they said, it's in the basement. There are like three vendors. I'm like, why? You've got like all these, there's like Magini, Stradivarius. They're like, there's Yamaha. I'm like, Yamaha? Yamaha's not a violin company. They said, okay, this entire floor is guitars. I said, why are there so many guitars? And they're just looking at this, that's American music. It's guitars. Are you out of your mind? And they said, okay, the whole second floor is piano. I said, what? Where's the violin? Hey, orchestras rule, man. They're like, no, orchestra's in the basement. So wow. I've learned a lot about how cultural literacy is important. What you think is really, really cool, Bach, Beethoven, and Brahms, in another locale, they have no clue. They're like, do you know anything about Johnny Cash? They're like, oh, I have a lot to learn.
But it's so neat because you've been able to kind of fuse that, like you bring in the classical instruments and vocals and mix them in with the the electronic beats. And I think that's so fascinating. Was that intentional on your part?
Yeah. Well, a lot of it is just being very open and being very humble. I was in a backyard barbecue. This is how the whole journey started when my kids were small. And then there was this guy, he was a producer for Madonna. And he said, "Hey, I really need a violinist on this one track we're building. Can you swing by the studio?" So I was like, "Oh yeah, sure." You know, it's like, okay. And I just finished working for Disney. So I thought I might try something new. And then he came over and said, "Okay, well, how would you like to track?" And I said, "I don't have any idea what you're talking about because I'm a classical musician." I said, "Where's the sheet music?" He said, "There's no sheet music. We're making new music." I said, "Oh, how do you do that?" He said, "Well, okay, we have a beat. Maybe you play to the beat, or maybe there's a specific bass or idea like riff or hook." And I said, "You just said a bunch of things. I have no idea what you said." He said, "Okay, well, if you're wanting to make new music and music that's not classical, you should just, LA is just 20 minutes from your house. You just go to LA and research. You're like in the creative distribution capital of the universe. You should just try that." So that's just started my whole journey into crossing from classical to EDM was the first one, then went over to alternative rock, and then traditional pop. And I got a lot of pushback from it. You know, it's funny because people are very into the idea of purity, just like a lot of Asians in America are very into the idea of purity. So they're like, "Oh, if you play violin, you should just stay in an orchestra or in classical music. Like if you go over to electric or anything else, you're not a violinist." I'm like, "Oh, that's funny. Why do you have to segregate violinists?"
Right.
I thought we fought segregation and now they're segregating me. And they're like, "Well, I just want to tell you, okay, so classical, they do not mix with hip hop, urban, they do not mix with jazz. They don't like country music. Country music, they don't like EDM. Now EDM, the dubstep people don't get along with the trance people who definitely don't like house, and trap, just forget it." And I'm like, we're just using music, which is supposed to be a welcome to everyone, as a way to divide everyone. That's an interesting concept, and it's a lot of wasted energy. And it's the same thing I see in the Asian community. And Henry Golden and I was just talking, he was like, "You know, the whole thing about being Asian is to celebrate your heritage and to move forward. And I've been criticized over and over that I'm not Asian enough." And I'm like, "I know." People always said to my kids, "You guys are not really Asian because your dad is Caucasian, so you're not really Asian enough." And I think that the Asians in Hollywood have to face this all the time, which is, "You're not really Chinese enough for this role, but we're going to cast a Caucasian person because they play it better." Right. And you're like, "Okay, wait a minute. This was an Asian role.
What does that mean?
Being Asian enough."
No.
And of course, like Chinese, Japanese, "Oh, then you're not Chinese. In Japanese, you're not Japanese." I was in a job interview once. It's a board position that I did get appointed for it. But there was this one board member and he said, "Do you speak Chinese?" And I said, "Yes." "Do you read and write Chinese?" I said, "I can do better." "Oh, then you're not really Chinese." I said, "Oh, that's interesting."
Wow.
Yeah. A lot of energy to make me not Chinese.
Right. It's like we set up our own, you know, challenges ourselves when we do things like that. I have to ask you something, Maki, though. As I'm listening to you, you make this sound all so easy, which I know it's not. It's been years of probably hard work and just really dedication. But was there ever a moment for you with the hearing impairment where you felt, "I can't do this," or "I feel challenged," or did you just always just keep pushing through? Was that the kind of personality you have? I mean, was there ever a challenge for you that came up?
Well, Rochelle, I love how you talk about challenges and how maybe a physical impairment could be a challenge. To me, the physical impairment was sometimes a challenge, but it was not as great of a challenge. It was a very small challenge compared to being a woman.
Oh, okay.
Being a woman.
In the music industry, right? Being in the music industry.
In everything. Music, in everything. Arts, working for Disney, company, corporate, going to the grocery store, standing, waiting around for the bus. To me, having a hearing impairment, yes, is very difficult, but it is a very small obstacle in comparison to being a woman.
Wow.
And my mother said the same thing, and she was a single mom, and her mother said the same thing, and she was a single mom, especially being a single mother.
Right.
It is a huge obstacle. My oldest one, once she was enrolled in private school, Catholic school, and she was like sixth grade, seventh grade. And all the mothers had a little meeting because it was a big gala for the school, a fundraiser for the school. And they said, okay, so all of us are coming in as a couple. So if you're a single mother and you're not coupled, you're going to work in the kitchen.
Are you kidding me? Wow, said, so that's what I'm saying. There we're setting up our own parameters and hurting our own selves, right? When we create this.
Why am I working in the kitchen? I can give the money for a ticket. Can I have my own ticket? Who are you going to bring? Well, it doesn't matter. I could bring a friend. I'm sorry, all the single mothers work in the kitchen. So that's how all the single mothers became friends. We were working in the kitchen and we were coming out serving all the people who were not single.
Do you think that's a challenge that we're still facing, or is that an obstacle that's been worked through?
Absolutely, absolutely. I actually have to pretend that my executive producer is my husband. I'll say, oh yeah, he's my husband. And then I'll put the ring on my wedding finger.
You are kidding me.
When I go to a conservative situation where they expect to see the CEO is married, properly married, married to a white guy is even better. I'm like, okay, I am married today. And everyone's like, oh my God, why?
Wow. So there's so much.
Especially for a woman. First of all, Rasha, I'm here all alone. I have my two kids and that's it. I don't have an uncle, brother, rich boyfriend, famous fiance. You know, I'm just by myself. I don't have my family here. And a couple of us are like that, like Senator Hirono of Hawaii. We had a whole conversation about this. She's all alone as well. She's married, but she doesn't have her family here. They're all in Japan. And we face very similar bias and prejudice. And it's sometimes very outright and it's sometimes very understated. But I do get this quite a bit, especially in Hollywood, where you're expected to come with someone who is famous or wealthy or who should be your boyfriend or whatever. It's unheard of in this day and age that we have a powerful woman who is quite happy to serve the community in the way she can. And that's somehow unacceptable. So for me, the greater obstacle is to showing my two children and their friends that as a powerful woman, you can be powerful by being yourself. And that's okay. That's hard for a lot of people. They're like, oh, you're powerful because of your watch or your title or your car or your guy or your dad. And I'm like, how about just power
comes from within?
From within. How about that? Let's try that.
I think it's beautiful that we can have that conversation and that I thank you for bringing that up, because I think for people who are watching or even listening, it's important to recognize that. Yeah, the power doesn't come from the external things, but it's how you're showing up to own yourself. We should have just gotten a cup of tea or coffee and just sat here, because I only have a few more minutes. And oh my gosh, you probably have so many incredible people you've worked with too, but I have to ask you, because you are the president and CEO of the Asian Hall of Fame, which I had the pleasure and honor of attending. And it's this annual induction ceremony, which really celebrates influential Asian leaders, artists. Can you talk about some of the success there and what inspired you and how this organization is really paving the path for generations to come?
I think that's the key, Rasha, is generations to come and why legacy is important. I mean, there are so many award shows out there where you're hot today, not tomorrow, and they only celebrate your success right now. The legacy is important. What you're leaving behind is important. What you stand for is important. And I really didn't know the power of that until I worked for Disney, which is all about the story of Disney and the family. And went into private equity and venture capital after that. And I also saw the power of story and heritage behind the innovation. So that to me, I thought, wow, you know, .com and VC and tech is really cool, but you really need some kind of story to root that innovation too. Karen Wong called me from Seattle, and she's 86 years old, and she has been directing her family's private philanthropy for 40 years. And they established Asian Hall of Fame as a private dinner party. It was a very intimate affair with just a couple of people, and they inducted some amazing people over the years, like Connie Chung and Christy Yamaguchi, just because she was a career attorney and she saw, after 160 years in the United States, the family still was kind of seen as just one of the families in Chinatown. And she thought, you know, we got to find a way to recognize in that time Asian American achievement. So she called me and she said, we really want to see how far this Asian Hall of Fame idea could go. Do you think that you could help us with this brand? Since you're a marketing person and we really need the ideas to make it into something bigger. So I took on the challenge in Russia. At that time, it was just a couple of months before COVID. We did not have a website. There was no Instagram. There was no engagement with Inditex. It was just a private dinner party. There were influencers and leaders, but they were not engaged. It was just, okay, thank you so much for your contributions. So I thought, you know what? If we really want to see how far it could go, and if heritage and legacy really, truly, it's where the future should go, we really need to, first of all, move the operations to Los Angeles, which we did, so we could get closer to our inductees, closer to production. So we moved it to LA. And the second thing I said was, we need to recognize that Asians in America also relate to those in Toronto, in Brazil, in the UK. There's a lot of cross-cultural commerce, plus we've got all these indigenous in Asia. So let's expand it to national, international, Asians and indigenous. So we did. And the third thing I said was, we have to start to think we're kind of like a time capsule of what Asian values, priorities, what character looks like. What is the Asian character and courage and contribution we want to show for generations to come? What does that look like? And then somebody said, well, what if you are born Korean, your parents are Korean, you speak fluent Korean or Korean national, but you are a Black DJ working in Korea. There's a famous Black DJ working in Korea, and he's Korean. Is he Korean or is he Black? And I said, hey, we welcome all. We welcome if you think you're Asian. And that's why on our criteria page, it says you must trace at least 25% of your racial, ethnic, or cultural heritage. That means if you're adopted, you're Caucasian, but you know you're Asian, and everyone says you're not Asian enough because you're white. If you're Eurasian, if you're multi-Asian, you know, Black Asian, we get a lot of talk from like Bruno Mars and other people who said, you know, we were always criticized that we were not Asian enough because we look Black. We want nothing to do with the Asian community because you've treated me and you treated my parents with disrespect for decades. So there's a lot of this healing that's a lot to be done. Mm-hmm. And that's what keeps me going with the Asian Hall of Fame. Yes, we're about the glam. Yes, we're about the sequins and the glitz. But at the end of the day, it's not just an award show. It's a way to recognize legacy and to show generations forward what heritage and pride should look like for all. I think that is very different. A majority of our audience members are actually not Asian, and a majority of our donors are not Asian because they want to see that Asian contributions and leadership can contribute towards East-West collaboration, bilateral content, interracial friendship. And this is so important for us. And it's actually one of the foundations that we continue to drive and continue to inspire.
Well, and it's amazing, Maki. I have to add that being there, I met so many incredible talents in various industries. And yes, you do see that influence. I think that the great thing was just seeing the influence that we've had also in the US and outside, but also the virtues, the ethics that the community carries. So I thought that was such a beautiful thing. I have just about 2 minutes here, so I'm going to leave with a fun question and ask you, if you could collaborate with any artist, living or dead, who would it be?
Oh, definitely Bach.
Oh
my gosh.
That would be fun.
I'm highly attracted to two things, which is probably why I'm still single.
It's so funny.
I'm really attracted to power plus genius times geeky, nerdy, obsessive. Like, I'm attracted to powerful nerds. Okay. I really get turned on by people who go deep into their thing and they're really into their thing. And Bach was really into the whole, you know what though? a close second, maybe, okay, Bach can step aside. The better genius is Debussy, because he used sacred geometry. He used like pentagonic scale to a T, and it was beautiful, and it was anti-establishment Russia, which I maybe, you know what, maybe I have to throw an anti-establishment a little bit in there.
That's a whole different level.
Like, let's just sprinkle. Let's how about a composer, artist, or guy who is a genius nerd who goes deep into his stuff, and he's a little bit of a rebel, because that's what Debussy was. That whole French Impressionist movement was, we are not composing just for the church. We're going to compose expressing our emotion, and that's what that whole movement was about. So I think, you know, forget Bach. I think it's going to have to be Debussy and his whole cohort of friends, Ravel, Dukas, Fauré.
One person, Maki, one.
Oh, yeah, that's not fair. That is not-
Well, it's been such a pleasure. You also recently launched your album, Down by the Water, that's just come out. Where can people find you on social media or website to learn more about your music, album, and all the amazing things that you're doing as a philanthropist, please, entrepreneur, and artist?
Yeah, thank you so much. And please Google Maki May, M-A-E, and then you should see the video that's on YouTube right now. It's kind of dark. It's talking a little bit about human trafficked woman who's killing the child in her mind, the daughter in her mind. Because PJ Harvey originally composed this saying the mother is killing her daughter under the water. So I flipped it by talking about the woman killing her inner child. It's dark and it's cool. We'd love for you to check that out. It's also on Spotify and all the other streaming platforms. And Rasha, of course, we're going to sign a promo flat to you and just send it directly to you as a thank you.
Oh my gosh. Yes. I'm so excited. Thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
I'm an advocate.
It has been such an honor speaking with you, Maki. Seriously, just even having a deeper dive into your history, your story, and just what you stand for the community. Really, thank you for paving the way, continuing to pave the way, and sharing your story here. So I do encourage everyone to look up everything that you're doing, your music, and just all the incredible things you have created and continue to create. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Rasha.
And for all of my viewers and listeners, we also would love to hear from you. So if you have any suggestions for topics, guests, or even any questions, do reach out to us. And don't forget to subscribe to our program on your favorite podcast platform. And follow us on Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, X, Instagram, and of course, our YouTube channel, like I was mentioning. And don't forget, Asian Pacific Voices Radio is produced by Asian Culture and Media Alliance, a nonprofit that empowers the Asian Pacific American communities with a voice through media arts. If you would like to support us or learn more about our programs, please do visit us at AsianPacificVoicesRadio.com. Once again, I'm Rasha Goel. Thank you for joining me on a thought-provoking and very interesting Asian Pacific Voices Radio. I will continue to bring you more exciting stories and guests throughout the year. Don't forget to join us next week and have a beautiful week ahead.